Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the court. My name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Eric Johnson, who was convicted in the Superior Court of burglaries as in a weapons offense. And that brings us to the issue in this case. In preparing or trying to grasp, says the issue here, and it was difficult to for me to get my thoughts around, I thought of analogous situations that the court could have addressed in the past and that would be, you know, elucidating, says, to this particular issue. And I tried to find some insight from court's prior decisions in similar areas. One that could arise that's similar to this issue is if a person steals a firearm and is charged with theft of a firearm, are they thereby, by committing the offense of theft of a firearm, a felony, also automatically guilty of the offense of possession of a firearm or weapon during the commission of a felony? You know, does the simple theft of a firearm automatically, says, result in two felonies, one of which involves mandatory time? This issue is similar in the sense that it presents the question of whether when a person commits a criminal trespass second degree, if they are in possession of a weapon, are they always then guilty of burglary? And in addition, are they always then guilty of, by virtue of the enhancement to burglary, possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of that felony? And unfortunately, I thought perhaps that the issue of a firearm, the theft of a firearm, and the weapons enhancer would have been addressed. But despite searching for it, I hope I didn't miss it, but I could not find that that issue had been presented to the court.
Can I interrupt because I must be confused here? I thought that the problem, if there is one, had to do with the fact that your client was charged with possession of a deadly weapon or a firearm by a person prohibited. That's not the same as just possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, is it?
No, it is not. And he was charged with possession of a deadly weapon by a person prohibited. However, that was severed from trial and later nolliprossed after he was convicted of the offenses that are now on appeal. So that's correct. He was charged with that. This is what the difficulty here is, that we believe that, like, we're relying on the court's decision in Buchanan, by and large. And in Buchanan, says, the court found that the fact of the entry into a house because the defendant was prohibited from entering into that house, that entry could not serve as both an element of the offense of the criminal trespass and also the element of the intent to commit a crime, contempt of the family court order. The court said it could not do double duty. We're arguing this morning that this is, in fact, a similar situation. Now, what we have here is a criminal trespass with a weapon, and you've got that similar bump. And it's not only, you know, in the popular terms, we hear of the Colbert bump. In fact, this is even better, says, for the state. It's kind of like a double bump. It's almost like analogous to the double jeopardy round in Jeopardy. Where the state gets to double down on its bet. They not only get to enhance the criminal trespass to burglary by virtue of possession of a weapon, but also enhance that burglary to possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony, a double bump.
And you're suggesting to us that this issue has never been confronted by the court before.
I did not find.
The closest case, in your view, is Buchanan.
Yes, sir. Now, the legislative's intent. The court has found, like the United States Supreme Court, that double jeopardy does not prevent convictions and sentencing under these circumstances if the legislature clearly intended to impose multiple punishments. We're contending that in this situation, it wasn't clear that the legislature was intending to impose multiple punishments, both burglary and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of that burglary. There are other expressions of clear legislative intent which get by the ordinary prohibition against multiple, says, punishments for the same conduct. For example, the offense of, there is an offense in Delaware, unlawful sexual conduct against a child, Section 779A. In that provision, enacted not too long ago, the statute says that, or when the statute was enacted, it said, nothing in this act shall be deemed to preclude prosecution under any other provision of this code. Unlawful sexual contact against a child is, in a sense, a status offense. It's where a sex offender commits a second sexual offense against a child. In a sense, it's a sentence enhancement. But the statute said when it was passed, nothing in this act shall be deemed to preclude prosecution. Another illustration is carjacking, first and second degree, and robbery, first and second degree. When the carjacking statutes were enacted, language was added, says, to that statute that's expressly said, nothing in this statute, the carjacking statutes, shall preclude conviction of the person for robbery. Robbery first, because in essence, the carjacking statute, except for the element of a car, is it's simply one more element of the offense of robbery. So robbery would ordinarily be a lesser included offense, but the legislature made clear that we're seeking multiple punishments for this offense. Another offense, selling stolen property. A person may be convicted of selling stolen property. If they've received stolen property and they sell it thereafter, that could be two offenses. Ordinarily, we'd look at it and say that, well, selling stolen property, you're in possession of it, you've received it, therefore, it's an included offense, you can't be punished twice. But the legislature said, no, nothing in this section shall be deemed to preclude prosecution under any other provision in this code. Likewise, money laundering under Section 51 contains an identical provision. Possession of a deadly weapon by a person prohibited, that contains a similar provision. The DUI, the vehicular assault and homicide law contains a similar provision. Driving under the influence is, according to the elements, a lesser include offense of either vehicular assault or homicide, depending, or vehicular homicide, depending upon its, how it's charged. But the legislature said that, expressly and clearly said, that a defendant may be convicted and punished for both offenses, although one is a lesser include offense of the other.
So, is it where you're going that in determining the intent of the legislature to allow double punishment, that the test is whether the legislature spoke explicitly in the statute at hand?
Yes, Your Honor.
It, in other words, the court cannot infer intent without some positive expression of legislative intent.
I don't believe so, not where there's a duplication of elements of the offense.
If I understand your argument, it's premised on the fact that this was a criminal trespass and not a burglary. Can you explain to me on these facts how this was simply a criminal trespass that was converted into a burglary second because the perpetrator possessed a firearm when he trespassed?
Well, the facts were, the evidence at trial were that, was that inferentially, there was a trespass, breaking into the premises, and a trespass.
But it's a residence, right?
That's correct.
There was someone in it at the time.
That's correct. The state, however, says did not believe that there was evidence to prove the element of intent to commit a crime therein, but there was evidence that they could prove a possession of a weapon. Therefore, they declined to indict for an intent, I presume, to commit a crime therein because they thought their evidence was lacking, and they thought they had stronger evidence with a sufficient to convict by possession of a weapon. So
the indictment is limited to second-degree burglary based on possession of a weapon?
That is correct.
Not any intent to commit another crime inside?
Correct, Your Honor. So, Another provision, likewise, in that instance, ordinarily, burglary, the intent to commit a crime therein, the intended offense, would ordinarily be a lesser included offense of a burglary offense, for example. But yet the legislature has specifically articulated that the defendant can be punished twice for both offenses, although one may be contained within the other, because the legislature said that burglary, a defendant may be convicted of both burglary and the offense that they intended to commit. Unlike, says, robbery. Robbery doesn't permit conviction for robbery and a theft, but burglary permits conviction for burglary and the theft and multiple punishments. So that, in Section 827 of the Code, is a specific articulation of the legislature's intent for multiple punishments. Likewise, many years ago, when the Court addressed the situation of weapons offenses in toto, along with felonies, the Court found that insofar as weapons offenses, felony weapons offenses, for instance, the offense of possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony, the felony was not a lesser included offense of the felony itself was not a lesser included offense of the possession offense, because in 1976, the legislature, the General Assembly, passed a statute saying that the defendant shall be sentenced for the weapons offense before, says, the underlying offense, and shall serve that first. Understandably, says, the Court recognized that as a clear expression of legislative intent to impose multiple punishments, although the predicate offense was an included offense of the weapons offense. And we submit that under these circumstances, that type of elevation does not apply because it is already, says, enhanced under, already enhanced from criminal trespass to burglary by virtue of the possession of a weapon itself, and Buchanan would prevent any further punishment, that double bump, so to speak. If the Court permits, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Did you want to make any statement about
the second issue?
Prohibited, the rejoinder issue?
The rejoinder issue? That is, there's no authority on that. It's an exercise of discretion. Our contention is that there was no harm to permitting rejoinder at that point. The state did not object because the state apparently didn't see any harm, and therefore it was an abuse of discretion. It's, you know, a simple argument.
The reason I brought it up is it fascinates me. Can you explain to me the tactical advantage of making an argument to please, please give the jury an opportunity to convict my client of another minimum mandatory offense?
Well, the trial prosecutor did have a reason for that, and he thought that if the jury had that offense before them, they would be less likely to convict of a weapons offense. It was, you know, I guess, intuition, so to speak. He just felt that based upon the way the evidence was going.
So a jury lenity kind of argument?
Sort of, yes.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it pleases the Court, I may just briefly go over the facts here, since my colleague did not. Mr. Johnson, who knew the owner of the house in question, whose name was Danielle Miller, after Ms. Miller had gone to work that day, he broke into the house and was in the process of looking around for something. He was rummaging around, knocking things over, emptying drawers. Unknown to Mr. Johnson, in the basement, living temporarily, was a woman named Antoinette Monks, who heard this and called the police on her cell phone. So the burglary was interrupted by the arrival of the police, one of whom stationed himself at the back door. When Johnson realized the police were here, he ran out the back door, and the officer outside by the name of Eric Johnson saw him. And he also saw that Mr. Johnson had a gun in his hand. He ordered him to stop. Johnson ran. That was a chase. The officer caught him. The gun was recovered. It was test fired. The gun was loaded. It was test fired and found to be operational. Because the burglary was interrupted, Johnson fled empty-handed. We have no idea what he was looking for. I talked to the prosecutor, the trial prosecutor, about his choice of charge. He said, quite frankly, we're not sure what the crime was he intended to commit. I mean, inferentially, since he was rummaging around, he was probably looking for something, but we're really not sure what it was. And I would just, since I could do the burglary second with the weapon under this section of the code, I chose that one because I was not sure I could convict him of burglary if I charged with the intent to commit the crime of theft therein. Mr. Johnson, other than the weapon, had no stolen property on his person.
Mr. Donovan.
So that was the reason for the charging decision. Now, I think I've relied primarily on the compstate, which is the possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. And I think what's important to realize here is that this section of...
Mr. Donovan.
Yes, sir.
Assume for the moment that there was sufficient evidence to charge and convict this defendant of burglary second, totally apart from any possession of a weapon.
Yeah.
In those circumstances, would with the fact that that defendant possessed a weapon create a double jeopardy problem if there were to be a double prosecution, both for possession of a weapon in the commission of a felony and a prosecution for burglary second?
No, there would not. That would not be an issue. Not be an issue at all. To the extent there's a double jeopardy problem, as identified by my colleague in this case, is that all the elements of the possession of a deadly weapon during commission of a felony are included in the crime of burglary second with a weapon. This is something that this court has addressed in the past, and there's a variety of cases going different directions, but the final word was Lecompte, possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of the felony of robbery in the first degree. And the reason I rely primarily on Lecompte in this case is that Lecompte, burglary second-degree weapon, was enacted in the 1974 code. It's been there since the beginning. Robbery in the first degree with a weapon, been in the code since the beginning. Possession of a deadly weapon during commission of a felony, during the code since the beginning. And I also cited to a Brown v. case, assault second-degree, elevating third-degree, to second degree with a weapon, again, in the code since 1974. All of these cases have been in there once. And in Lecompte, the court, certainly in one of its, I think its primary analysis, says, look, all this robbery statute and the possession of a deadly weapon during commission of a felony statute were enacted at the same time. These cases came in, all these statutes came in all together. And presumably, when the General Assembly said in its punishment section on 1447, the possession of a deadly weapon, that this should be served, the time, mandatory time, should be served prior to time served for the felony. They intended, the legislature intended, had their eyes wide open that other felonies could be used, and that was the primary reason this court found in Lecompte that robbery first degree and possession of a deadly weapon during of a felony could stand, even though the elements of one were in fact included in the other.
Is there any meaningful distinction between bumping robbery second to robbery first because the robbery took place with the deadly weapon in the possession of the perpetrator, and bumping criminal trespass to burglary in the second degree?
No, I think the legislative intent that one finds in the code commentary, now I realize that's more the rationale of the code committee but rather than the legislature, but it is, once again, that the danger of a nonviolent crime suddenly becoming violent. That's why the general, the co-committee and the General Assembly, presumably, has come down hard on these weapons crimes since the initial code in 1974. You can go ahead and commit felonies if you have to. But one thing we do not want you to do is carry a deadly weapon while you do it, because then your felony, whatever it may be.
Well, I would think that the argument from the other side is you get that enhancement, you fulfill the legislature's intent when you bump criminal trespass to the felony of burglary in the second degree.
Sure.
And the argument is, but you can't have it both ways. You can't have the enhancement of the possession of a deadly weapon in order to bump it to burglary second, and at the same time get a double bump from possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of the felony, which depended upon possession of a weapon.
Yeah, and this court has considered that, both in the bumping from robbery second to robbery first, and also in the context of assault, which goes from assault third degree, a misdemeanor, to assault second degree, a felony, and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of that felony.
Well, is criminal trespass a felony or a misdemeanor?
That's a misdemeanor.
Well, isn't there a difference between bumping robbery second to robbery first, one felony to a felony with a greater punishment than a misdemeanor being bumped to a felony and then doubly enhanced by possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of that felony?
Well, I believe that was my colleague's argument, but again, the cases dealing both with assault third to assault second. Assault third is a misdemeanor, assault second is a felony. It's the same increase in severity, and now you go over that line from misdemeanor to felony, whereas, as the court just pointed out, you do not when you go from, say, robbery first, robbery second to robbery first, but you do up the severity one level in or a level in either case. So my position then is that Lecompte is controlling in this case, and I rely on the fact that this burglary second weapon statute has been on the books since 1974. And it's not a recent statute that was passed, and maybe the General Assembly, you know, just wasn't thinking at the time. But the 1974 code, as I'm sure all are aware, was a big deal, and Delaware's first comprehensive criminal code. And presumably, the General Assembly, when it enacted these statutes, knew what they all were, and they were all enacted together at the same time, and knew what the consequences of that were, which was what the this court's rationale in Lecompte zeroed in on.
So based on Lecompte, you'd say this is not a case of first impression for us?
I mean, it's the case of first impression in considering burglary in the second degree. It's not a case of first impression considering weapons and neither is it a case of first impression from the bumping from misdemeanor to felony level because of Evans, actually, and the Brown case, which cites to Evans, I believe. Well, the court has no further questions. I think I've made my position clear. As far as the second issue goes, this was a matter of discretion on the trial judge's part. The judge's concern was under Rule 403 that this would lead to confusion of the issues. The testimonial phase of the trial was basically over. The jury heard nothing about persons prohibited. They have not been mentioned in opening statements. And to suddenly spring on the jury, oh, by the way, we have another charge for you to consider. This would just lead to unwanted speculation. And so regardless of the merit of defense counsel's reasons for wanting to do that, I think the judge, independent of that, had his own reasons for not wanting to do that at this stage, that it would lead to confusion of the issues, and this was a discretionary call on the part of the trial judge, and I think I maintain not an abuse of that discretion.
Thank you.
In its argument, the state summarized the evidence presented at trial. The defense had a different view of that as a trial. The state contends that the evidence showed that the defendant had broken in and rummaged around and was probably going to steal or something, but the state had a case of possession of a weapon during that break-in, and therefore they indicted. Actually, the defense argued that at trial, the state's evidence was insufficient that the defendant broke in. In fact, the defense tried to raise reasonable doubt by arguing that the evidence was insufficient to prove that the defendant had been inside. The police officer did not see him inside, and the evidence was consistent with the defendant having been outside. And then when police responded, says to the break-in, and saw the defendant fled. So the defense was trying to obtain an acquittal based upon a different view, says, of the same evidence, and asking the jury to draw different inferences. And that's also why the defense counsel realized the state's circumstantial case was weak, the defense wanted to bring back in that person prohibited charge to focus the jury's attention on that, and says argued that the state's evidence that the defendant had been inside was insufficient, and obtain, you know, a run of the table, so to speak, and get an acquittal for all offenses. So that was the rationale behind that. And I have nothing else to address in rebuttal unless the court has any questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.